Hello, and welcome to Peter's Podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me.
Oxy.
You may wonder what that means in Sanskrit. It's not in Sanskrit. We're trying to speak Finnish. Why? Because we're in Helsinki. Namaste, Wendy.
Namaste.
Uksikaksi.
Uksikaksi.
Kolme neljä.
Neljä.
Neljä visi.
Visi.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Check 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Check.
Not check, but Finn. Or Suomi, as they say here. Yeah, so hi everyone. Welcome to Peter's Podcast.
This is what happens when you're not used to white nights.
Yes, and white nights not with a K, but with N's, where it doesn't get dark here.
Yeah.
So we're pretty much up whenever we feel like it, and being on jet lag, it's frequent.
It's fun, fun, fun.
Yeah.
Fun.
But anyway, we've been teaching in Finland in a 200-hour teacher training with some lovely Finnish students. And we've been doing some workshops on meditation, on the Yoga Sutras, on
yoga
in general. And we're going to continue that through some other places in Finland, like Seinäjoki, which is in the western area of Finland. And then we intend to travel a little bit more around Europe and do some workshops there. And I'll keep posting where we're going to be on my website, peterfurco.com.
And we're going to end up in France, in Normandy, which some of you may know, the 14th to the 19th of August for a retreat at a lovely retreat center. Rustic, former mill. And so if any of you would like to think about joining us, go to Peter's website, www.peterfurco.com, and check it out.
Exactly. And today, we thought we would share a little of what we've been talking about in workshops and other places, which is something about the last two padas or chapters, you could say, of the Yoga Sutras, and also the second and third parts of my subtitle for this podcast, which is Real Yoga, Actual Happiness, and Deep Living. So we thought we would give our after breakfast chat, after meditation chat about that, taking into account that our sleep patterns have been very disrupted. What is the name of the third pada of the Yoga Sutras?
In Sanskrit,
yeah,
called Vibhutipada. And in English, there have been many words used to describe what that means. Sometimes people say it's the powers. That goes way off for me. Sometimes the gifts or the results of your yoga. But the way that I like to think of it is, and this is right out of my work with Alan Finger on the Tantra of the Yoga Sutras, that it is what happens when we start to channel the wisdom that we, the insights rather, maybe we would have a better word of insights, that we get from our yoga practice, right? The practice phase of our yoga. Vibhuti is what happens when that starts to weave back into our life and starts to change us and transform us, right? It's not the part we do, but the part that we...
That comes as a result.
That comes as a result of what we do.
Yeah.
That we're not doing anymore.
Yeah. And I that's something that I was emphasizing a bit in the workshop that I had yesterday, that, you know, doing the practice, you can gain certain insights and certain philosophy, and you can understand things better And that's a component of it, especially if you're a teacher or, you know, you're just of a philosophical nature. But the more important part is that you go through a change by doing practice. You evolve almost in the way, I didn't say this yesterday, but I often think of it this way, like the way that children grow up and they're changing as they're growing. They're literally, you know, as Uta Alto was saying in her anatomy lectures, you know, your bones are growing based on the activities that you do.
They're literally changing shape.
Yeah.
Like the muscle pulls on a bone in a particular insertion or origin, and it changes the shape, like it forms a ridge by pulling.
Right. Yeah. And in our minds and in our spirit, in our, you know, the mind that deals with the senses and the part of our conscious awareness that we take advantage of, that grows also, that the ease of moving between those two aspects of ourself evolves as we practice.
Yeah.
So that it's not like you have to understand something to see the vibhuti.
Right. The problem, I think, is that people are just so unaccustomed to thinking of things in that way, where there's an active phase and a passive receptive phase. And, you know, in yoga, we're always looking at that, you know, primarily because of the gunas, for those of you who know that language. For those of you who don't, just tuck that away somewhere for later. But, you know, if we have this active phase, if we're doing something, it's active. And if we're done doing it, it's not just over, right? That it created an effect, mm-hmm. which we're not used to pausing and understanding, right? And that's that growing, right? Like, you know, you could use a natural metaphor where you plant a seed and the planting is active. You're doing it. You have to, you know, get the seed and dig a hole and put it in the ground and put the dirt back and water it and, you know, make sure that it's got all the nutrients and stuff. That's all the stuff that you do. But then you don't just walk away and be like, I'm done, right? The fun is in the growing of the plant,
right?
The observing and the watching and seeing what kind of plant it is. And you're not doing that part, right? It's doing it itself, because that's the nature of a seed, is to grow into the plant that it's going to be.
Right.
But we are so, I think, conditioned to just do. And in my other training, in my polarity training, you say, when you do.
Yeah.
That's just a way of teaching observing.
Right. You know, and it's funny too, because that observing part is something that requires a great deal of patience, and it's on its own timeline.
Exactly.
The not doing part is on its own timeline, which in Sanskrit we would perhaps call Ishvara Pranidhana. I mean, that's a very specific mm-hmm. thing of allowing the universe to do its piece. And, right. you know, like a little kid who plants a seed is like always driven to like, I'm going to dig it up and see if it's growing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, where mm-hmm. you can't do that's them. More doing that isn't effective, isn't helpful, right? So you have to just allow, and then the growing takes place in it of its own,
exactly
the way the universe does that.
You know, and you can kind of milk that metaphor even a little bit more and talk about the fact that, you know, you can't tell a seed what it's going to be.
Right.
You really have to just do. You have to show up, plant the seed, and step back, and then allow what's going to be.
Right.
And get in, you know, yoga is really what happens when we get in alignment with that
right.
thing, whatever it is.
Right.
Right? We don't kind of give up our power completely by surrendering to that acceptance. You know, we still have to show up and plant the seed and right. have an intention about what we want to manifest.
Right, but then again, you have to let go what it's going to be, how it's going to be.
You can't really dictate that part.
Right. Like I'm letting my beard grow. And I have no idea what it's going to be.
I know what it's going to be. I don't know what it's going to be.
Yeah. So we'll see.
Yeah.
I'm away. It's like being on vacation.
Yeah. But getting old is a good example of that. You know, we can only do what we can do, but the fact of nature is that we do age.
Yeah.
And then if you're not going to get in alignment with that, if you're going to try and, you know, manipulate that,
right?
you know, how much doing is positive, and how much doing is serving you, and how much is just kind of wasting your energy, really.
Right, right. Yeah. I remember I had a colleague in a job way back in the 90s, and his girlfriend was Swedish. He was American. His girlfriend was Swedish. And he said that she came into the bathroom one morning, and then she came running out all gleeful and said, "Look, I have a wrinkle."
Mm-hmm.
Because in her culture, that was a sign of wisdom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we don't really value that so much mm-hmm. in our culture. And I, you know, the thing that I see the most is this sort of, it goes culture to culture, you know. In Finland, you see it in one way. In the U.S., you see it in a very different way. But this kind of self-talk that's all about success and failure. And we're supposed to succeed and we're not supposed to fail. And then we get into this very intense inner dialogue about trying and not trying and being popular and not being popular and succeeding and failing. And we really forget that, you know, the most successful, quote unquote, I'm really putting that in quotes, right? The most successful endeavors are usually the ones in which the person has tried and failed many times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And so there's this ability to see the bigger picture, to see yourself as bigger than the little piece of it, which is the failure, right?
Yeah.
It didn't work out. You tried something and it didn't work out,
yeah.
you know, and then you try again and it didn't work out, and you try again and you learn something every time. We're back to that same concept,
right.
of learning and growing.
Yeah. And that's a nice segue into something about the Vibhutipada. I'm reading Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic right now as a little bit of a way to prep for our retreat that's got a creativity component in it. And, you know, she talks quite a lot about the reasons why we would take on an activity like this, trying to succeed versus trying to avoid failing and things like that. And, you know, when you are aligning yourself through your practice with that balancing of letting go, receiving, you said insight, I think you used
mm-hmm.
that word, right?
Yeah.
Insight. Then as you allow that insight to guide you, you start to do the things that are your karma. You start to align with your own motivations. You could use that word as a parallel for karma, like what motivates you through life. And it's going to be challenges as well as ease, right? Things that you're good at, but also the things that you need to take on will constantly keep presenting themselves. So one of the nice things that Elizabeth Gilbert said in her book is, you know, often I'm not trying to write something to be successful. I'm trying to write something for me to understand
to learn something,
right?
Mm-hmm,
and she said the craziest example of that was that she had written several novels and she'd been a journalist and all this stuff. And then she was really trying to process this one piece of what was going on in her life. And it became this memoir, which she had no other experience in writing. And it just happened to resonate with so many people and became this blockbuster.
Well,
and she's, you know, ever since then, she's never thought, oh, I have to write the sequel to Eat, Pray, Love, until there was something else to write about for herself.
Right. Well, can you bring that back around?
To the Vibhutipada?
Mm-hmm, to what you were talking about, yeah.
That you're trying to, in your own life, align through your practice and then follow the inspiration that you're given, not worrying about succeeding or failing. But just by your nature, you are succeeding
mm-hmm.
because you're who you are and
right.
you're going to do what is your thing. So if you just keep pursuing what feels like the best route, you know, with some, and all the tips that you get, like be persistent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, being persistent just means being true to what feels right
mm-hmm.
in you, not giving up on that.
Yeah, I'm really struck with all of the language about that it's a somewhat of an emotional journey too. Like, we're not just using our mind to accomplish something. We're actually using our mind as a some sort of a navigation tool, but it's in relationship with our emotions and in relationship with our intuition. And, you know, the thing for me is that it kind of comes down to keeping a balanced relationship between vision, right? Like that part where you see where you're going, right? And to me, that's samadhipada. That's the first, that's the overview, right? That's like the part where you see it, but it's not accomplished yet. So you haven't lived with it yet. So keeping in balance between that place of vision and that place of doing, right? Because the doing is always got to relate back to the intention or the vision, right? And if it does, that's kind of how I see what you're saying, you mm-hmm. know, that you have to kind of do something and then relate it back to your vision, do something and relate it back to your vision. And when you do, that's kind of how you get into that alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you've gone through sadhanapada and vibhutipada with that, mm-hmm. right? That's the walk, right?
Yeah.
And then when you get to the fourth pada, you're sort of integrated. You've already integrated how to do that balancing of vision and manifestation
to the level right? you can this time
around. To the
around.
Level you can in this moment, even yeah. this time around,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that the manifestation then is starting to come from the vision.
Yeah.
Through the constant alignment and realignment
yeah.
of your actions.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the really exciting part, you know?
Yeah.
But it gets hard when you're just sort of in a some sort of a pain loop, yeah. whether it's mental, emotional, or physical,
yeah.
you know?
Well, let me take that into the Tantra from the perspective of Tantra as energy, so that, like, in our chakra system, you said, you know, this involves emotion, this involves vision. It's like, you know, the different parts of us, energetic body speaking, right, have these different roles, and we have this visioning component in the ajna chakra that has mm-hmm. a way of understanding what is it that's coming through my meditation,
mm-hmm.
right? We have this expressive chakra, visuddha, that's like, how do I make something of what I'm feeling is my way, mm-hmm. right? And then you also have this second chakra in the Svadhisthana that is like, I'm driven towards this, I love this, or I hate this, I don't want that. And how do you bring all of that relationship then energy in the heart center to figure out what is, which part of this emotion is inspired or has insight guiding it, and which part is pattern or habit or mm-hmm. the thing that I'm trying to actually learn to release.
Mm-hmm.
And so then through all of the practicing, the insight, and the component we haven't mentioned yet, which is the Svadhisthana, the Svadhyaya, understanding yourself through self reflection, I think you used the word mm-hmm. the other day,
mm-hmm.
you know, helps you sort that all out.
Well, one of the ways that I think about it, how do you know, this has been coming up for me a lot lately, actually, you know, how do you distinguish, right? And
yeah.
it becomes about mastery, becomes about being able to distinguish.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that I have learned to, one of the tools that I have learned to use is to be very kind of radically honest about what I'm experiencing on the outside. And if it looks like struggle to me, I'm trying to let go of it a little bit quicker. And if it looks like ease, like it's almost like a big green arrow, like go
right,
this way,
because right, right.
that's really easy. You know, it's hard in some ways, like I'm set up, like if it's too easy, I'm just going to not go there because
yeah.
that's just, I'm so used to struggle.
Yeah.
That's kind of my karma, right? And there's something to be said for being able to go through a big, long struggle and come out the other end. I'm not knocking that. But at the end of the day, you got to let go of your struggle too. And so that easy way, right? Easy is like a different sounding word than easeful, right? But that easy or easeful way, you know, that's one of the tools that you can learn. Like if that's the way you should go, that's the way you should go. Yeah. It feels a certain way.
Right.
And I
to
and
be
I,
able to tune into that
to
is
be able, yes, an exactly. element of mastery. And that's an element of mastery. Like, you don't get that right at the beginning necessarily. And I think that's really important for people to know. You know, like, it's okay to be in your struggle when you're in it, but it's time to let go, then you got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Too, you know.
Yeah, and a theme that's been coming up a lot in my own lectures and whatnot is that you get better at distinguishing what's what through practicing and through time. You know, like, as you continue to practice, in the beginning you're just like, I don't know, is this the right thing to do? Mm-hmm. I don't know, right? And then eventually you start getting these little indications, kind of like when, you know, you think about somebody and then they call you on the phone. Like, mm-hmm. when that first happens, it's like, that's amazing. But when it happens 15 mm-hmm. times, you start to think, well, that's just a thing that happens to mm-hmm. me. And it's the same way. Like, when you start to get a feeling about this yeah. is the right thing to do, at first you don't necessarily trust it, or it just seems like some weird feeling. But the more you feel it, the more you start depending on it, and the more confidence you have yeah. around, you know, I think this is the right thing to do.
I just had that with Lotta Norberg in Sweden. I was here in Helsinki and I was meditating one morning, and then I finished my practice and I went online and I got on Facebook, and she had sent me a picture of flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And in my meditation, I had, like, at the end of my meditation, for whatever reason, she popped into my mind and I was thinking about her. So I just wrote back, you know, you psychic Pisces, you.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, I'm not ever, like, surprised by this anymore.
Right.
You know? And
right.
it is quite a developmental thing, I think. And that goes back to vibhuti, right? Because
right.
you do your practice and, you know, not everybody gets the same capabilities, or, you know, not everybody has, like, a psychic sense of smell, or, you know,
right.
ability to perceive, you know, transcendent color, or, you know, I'm just making things up, but
yeah.
but everybody has different way of receiving that information,
right?
But
yeah, and the
stuff being surprised about it,
and the nice segue into the fourth pada is when Lotta says, I don't feel surprised about that anymore. The flip side way of saying that is, this is what it feels like when I feel mm-hmm. connected
yeah.
and when I feel that life is more than just what's coming through my five senses.
Yeah.
When I'm used to going back and forth and receiving yeah. these insights, it feels freeing, liberating, bigger, mm-hmm. spacious.
You know, what keeps coming into my head is that there's this idea, and I think it comes up, you know, in both the third and fourth padas, that the main thing, it's about samyama. It's sort of towards the end of the discussion about samyama, and it talks about how, you know, the main thing that we're trying to learn to distinguish between is the Atman and the Buddhi, right? That is the part of ourselves that is beyond the senses, and the part of us that part that's beyond the senses, there's part of us that's perceiving the senses that's from beyond the senses. And then the part of us that is automatically involved in the senses, the mind, right? That doesn't have the ability to kind of get outside of that process, right? And that in our place of integration, right? When we're starting to really learn how to receive the benefit of our practice,
mm-hmm.
that's the main thing that happens, is that's where we learn to make that particular distinction. And you know, that's to me a question of meditation. You know, you just get that by meditating, period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where you get that.
Yeah. And the rest of yoga practice, all the things that many of us come to yoga for in the first place, those all are the support system for that meditation.
Absolutely.
So that the meditation is fruitful.
We have eight limbs.
Yeah.
The eight limbs bring us from the second pada into the third pada.
Mm-hmm.
It's the bridge, right? And meditation is that bridge.
Yeah. And the samyama that comes out on the coming out. And for those of you who are not so familiar with that term, it's that almost like a blending moment where you're in meditation, but you're on the razor's edge between that state of mind and your normal way of thinking. So it's fruitful for bringing more insight, more understanding of the things that you are having to deal with in living. And in the Ishta diction, Ishta meditation practice, we literally target that meditative insight into each of the chakras so that they're all functioning in ways that serve to weave that insight into our living.
Mm-hmm.
In Artha Vatva Samyama.
You've put me into a still point.
We're just going to meditate for a minute here,
yeah,
guys.
Yeah, hold on. Wait, I'm coming back, I promise.
Yeah.
It's that white night.
Yeah.
All the time
sun. And
the
finished coffee is not that strong, so it doesn't really have the same rajasic push that our Brooklyn coffee has, even though there is a shop here called Brooklyn Coffee.
Well, I don't drink coffee, but I'm drinking my green tea from Brooklyn, and it's doing its job, but I'm still being prone to go into still point here.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we're doing while we're here, and you can see that one of the things of the time change and all is it's creating more vata because we're wandering
for
around
sure
in these topics, right? Vata being that energy of movement, like the wind.
You should have been with me in my meditation this morning. We were all over the place.
Yeah. Is that we're going to participate in a yoga festival on a lovely island out in the archipelago of Finland, just a little boat ride away from Helsinki, and it's called Magnesia.
And the festival,
the
is,
festival
called
is
Magnesia.
Called Magnesia. The island is called Lonna. And so we're going to talk to yoga teachers and yoga practitioners who are coming out to this festival about some of these topics. I think my workshop is called Yoga for Deep Living, Real Happiness, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a talk that's a little bit targeted to teachers.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah. It's in the section for teachers,
mm-hmm.
And I think it's about. It actually comes a little bit out of my work in polarity, but it's talking about how as teachers we can learn to cultivate the observer in our teaching, right? So how we work with the gunas as teachers, how we can embrace the active teacher seat or teacher role as well as the receptive student role, and how we can kind of balance that by just staying in that observer place when we're teaching so that we can be in it, but not of it. And
mm-hmm.
that's a real concept from yoga.
Mm-hmm.
But that we kind of, I think, don't very much think about consciously.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that teaching is our, you know, once we become teachers and we're sharing that our yoga with people, then that kind of becomes our yoga. Teaching
right.
becomes our
a
yoga.
Part of our yoga.
And we need
yeah.
to think of it that way.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a pep rally for teachers.
Yay. So anyway, I'll put a link in the show notes to the Magnesia Festival.
Yeah.
In case you happen to be heading through Finland at that moment.
Happen to be right around the island of
Which my sister and her family will be.
Yeah.
In her book, Big Magic, Elizabeth Gilbert said, "To call someone a creative person is a redundancy. We're all creative by nature." We're going to explore that and other topics related to living in a graceful way at our retreat, Yoga and the Art of Living Creatively, in France this August. Get more information about it at peterfurco.com/France2018. Look forward to seeing you there. What in terms of that fourth pada could you say in terms of like we're a little bit weaving one way of looking at things on top of another in this chat, but you know, the padas versus those eight limbs, like you in the fourth pada, it's describing this feeling, this way of being that's quote unquote freedom,
mm-hmm.
You know, which to me always has an element of a spaciousness and ability to see things more as they are. And how do you see that as relating to this continuous spiraling through the practicing?
So, yeah, that's such a good question, and it's not the easiest one to answer, but...
That's why I asked
The short answer is that when we take on doing our practice, and I, like, capital P, not, like, lowercase p, mm-hmm. you know, we're doing it as a way of living.
A sadhana,
right?
Yeah.
When we do that and we really start to get a little bit established in that, so that, you know, we're more in that frame of mind than not, then what happens is that we start to channel, like we start to live from the experience of samadhi, not living in the experience of samadhi, but we're kind of staying more tapped into that insight, into that way of perceiving, which is what happens when you're perceiving from a place beyond the dual mind, right? Beyond the place where you're like, I have to do this because then I get that, and then the next thing is that linear place.
Right.
And so when we can live from that place more, it's kind of integrated. It's
right.
I think of it like, you know, your practice gets a little bit more subtle,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't need to do a whole big asana, you know, 2 hours of asana and, you know, lots and lots and lots of meditation. You just kind of need to sit down and remember who you are, where you are, and what's right. going on, and tap back in.
Right.
And then it's coming through.
Right.
Right. That's, to me, spaciousness.
Right.
Freedom. It's basically freedom from, I mean, if you want to go like to the higher register of explaining that, it's freedom from the living in the dual mind,
mm-hmm.
right? It's freedom from creating new karmic struggle.
Yeah.
Right? That's the big answer, bigger
right.
answer.
Right. Freedom. Yes.
Right.
And you know, you described like taking a moment to do a meditation, and the more practiced that you get at navigating those states of mind, the more easy it is. I was speaking with one of the students after the meditation workshop yesterday, and she really enjoyed the techniques we did. But she said, you know, I find I don't really need to do so much techniques
mm-hmm.
to get to my meditation anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a common experience mm-hmm. in the arc of people's meditation practice.
Yes.
So when it isn't so hard, you might still need to do some kind of practicing to be able to sit for a longer meditation, but to just tap into that spacious way of thinking about things. In other words, like to grab enough of that clarity to then have the samyama to see, okay, so what should I do in this moment of my challenge? That part can become very fast. Like
mm-hmm.
literally you blink your eyes if your intention is to receive insight.
You know, I agree with you, but I also don't want to set up a thing where people get like unrealistic, because the other way you can think of it is that, you know, it just keeps you able to go through whatever struggle your karma is going to throw at you and let it go at the right time. Like, also be able to resolve it, right? So in that fourth pada, I really love that it at the very end it says, you know, and even if you're completely established in your yoga and you basically are doing what you just said, some scars can always arise. And when they do for you, enlightened yogi, then you have to go back to your practice.
Right.
It could always happen,
right.
right? Because we are not necessarily able to dictate when and how those things come up.
Right.
Right? All we can really know is that we met the challenge and that challenge for now is done.
Right. And using challenge as a marker, you know, using challenge and dealing with challenge as a marker, life is, by its nature, full of conflict. So when you're capable of meeting a challenge, of satisfying some karmic lesson, some karmic work, as Al usually says, or some karmic play element, as I like to say, you know, you get another one.
You get another one, exactly. I mean, I'm always really amazed by that. I'm a little bit pissed off when it first hits. I'm like, come on, you know, don't I get 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Hello. But I just wanted to also give an example, like from our marital life. We tend to get like locked into this. We're both quite pitta. And if something comes up where you think one thing and I think another thing, you know, we'll sort of go like, well, I think this and I think this. Well, you know, and we'll get a little pitta about it, a little aggressive. And the other day we had that about something coming up, or just a simple little detail about the retreat, technical detail. And you said, I think we should do this. And I said, I disagree. I think we should do this. And I could feel it coming. And I realized this is just a huge pattern that we go through. So I just decided to relate to it differently, because what I heard was that that wasn't going to get resolved in that moment, and that it needed further discussion, and that there needed to be some kind of conversation that allowed us to collaborate on the outcome. But from that place of, you know, one opinion versus another, it was pretty black and white.
Like they say in New England, you can't get there from
here. So just having that momentary thought, oh, this, you can't get there from here. We just sort of mutually decided to let it go for now. And it's still not decided, but it's really a small detail, you know? So that kind of thing, that's the kind of thing I think that gets easier and easier the more access you have to that. I mean, that was just a very little, like, all I really need to do was take a breath. And I think that's sort of initially how we perceive the growth, right? That the little things that we were doing in some kind of a repetitive pattern start to, we start to get some awareness, and then we start to be able to make the change, the sadhana piece that lets it change. And then once we start to integrate that new action, we start to be able to like just have a new way.
Yeah.
And that's that bone changing, right? That's right. That, you know, if you pull on the bone with the muscle in that way long enough, it just creates a new ridge.
Right.
And then you start acting differently. Right. And then you start being different and feeling different.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, the proactive, and maybe there is no proactive short of having the insight, you know. I mean, the two go together, like you took a breath, you know, you had a realization. But like when I'm wandering off to give a lecture or give a workshop, and I'm like, wait, what am I talking about? You know, and there's a little of that natural anxiety that pops up. You know, I will literally like surrender. I'll go to that spot. And even if I'm walking down the street, you know, my eyes close, I take two steps with my eyes closed, my mind is aiming to meditate, you know, and then I come back in and it's like, right, I'm going to trust that the right stuff is going to come out. And it's like,
whoosh. Yeah.
And so those things become available in a more almost miraculous way, which is often, again, what that third pada gets
attributed
to. Yeah, go ahead.
And just to add to that the main thing that it says in that third pada about the vibhuti, right? If you want to call these things the powers, right? The effects, is that you don't own them, right? The part of you that identifies as the ego, whatever you want to call it, we talk about it as the ego. The individual identity. I, Wendy Newton, am doing this power, and completely shuts it off, right? So what you're talking about is giving up ownership of that resolution and just inviting it in, because that's how it works, right? The universe, I mean, gosh, this always sounds so like it goes into this very vague language for me, but, you know, the universe contains everything in it, and we are at some level just completely connected to that everything. So if we let go of the individual mind's relationship to what needs to happen right now, it often just happens mm-hmm. in the way that is best, not just for me, but for the whole situation.
Right.
And it's so hard to see that. That's right. The perspective that we miss when we're just walking around thinking, what do I need?
Yeah.
How am I going to help? How am I going to get what I need? Right.
Yeah.
Even how am I going to help becomes difficult sometimes. Right. So, right.
Yeah. And you saying it that way made me think about the situation we have in classes of teaching something like yoga or teaching a lecture about yoga or meditation or something, that it's so easy to get caught up in a thing of, oh my God, am I saying the right thing? Are they going to get it? Is this good enough? And all those kinds of things. Whereas if you allow, chances are people will get it. We get mm-hmm. to see it very explicitly because we sit in the same room sometimes and one of us will be talking and the other one is listening. Mm-hmm. And the one who's listening is, you've told this to me and I've said it to you. It's so many times you're like, wait a minute, she's not getting the question. I know I could say that so much better.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just shut up, if you just allow what's yeah. flowing through, you see afterwards that, the person totally got it.
Mm-hmm.
They got what they needed. The way that someone said it was just right.
Mm-hmm.
And
sometimes, this is the real kicker too, as the teacher even, you got to let go of thinking that you know what everybody got.
Right.
I mean, that would be impossible. Like I would limit what people get because I need to know. That doesn't seem right to me.
Mm-hmm.
I can only do my piece. And then my job after that is to get spacious enough to be able to, understand as much as I can, but not, I never want to try and take on the role of I don't know what to call it. Right. I don't want to claim the role of universal knowledge
yeah.
in any given situation.
Dictator of knowledge. Yeah.
Of even observing kind of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's not humility speaking. I'm not a particularly humble person. That's something else, that I don't know what to even call it. Like that's just seeing things in their proper perspective. For me, that is what that is.
Yeah. Yeah, knowing our role, which yeah. also comes from the practice. We see clearer and clearer, more and more insight about what it is that we can do, what it is that we should do. And it's this fascinating blend of abhyasa vairagyam, to act and to be unattached to the outcome, to be unattached in so many ways.
Yeah.
And yet to continue to act.
Exactly.
A lot of times when we have this conversation.
That's the fourth pada.
Yeah, with people who are activists, they're really, their buttons get pushed by this notion of, what do you mean don't be attached to the outcome? Mm-hmm. The outcome is in everything. We want to make yeah. change.
Yeah. But it's almost like it's like an inverse relationship because, this was coming up in your lecture tomorrow. Sorry to cut you off, but it's like...
My lecture tomorrow?
Sorry, it's the White Knights. Yesterday. Uh-huh. this was coming up in your lecture tomorrow.
Yeah.
So it seems to me to kind of be a little bit of an inverse relationship from what we're taught, that accepting the situation as it is actually enables proper action in the world. It doesn't mean accepting it and doing nothing, right? So the other way of seeing it would be to say, this is wrong. I have to take action. Well, starting out with this is wrong means that you haven't accepted something about what's happening, mm-hmm. right? When you judge like that, right, you make black and white statements, it assumes that your perspective is the right perspective, right? And that whatever's not part of your perspective shouldn't exist.
Right.
And when you act from that place, you sometimes get into conflict.
Right.
Right. But when you accept the whole picture more or less as it is, then you can relate to the whole picture in some way that allows you to act with less conflict,
yeah,
and less struggle. And that's all that means. But it's very hard to articulate that point in a world where surrender means giving up, and in a mm-hmm. world where acceptance means doing nothing about it,
mm-hmm.
right? This fine just as it is, mm-hmm. right? It's not that's already a judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, maybe we need to write a book about that, because
mm-hmm.
it's hard to explain it. And it's like, it's a whole workshop on its own, you know?
Yeah, and I think in your mentioning of what I said yesterday, it was that notion that a life with no drama, that has no conflict, is nothing, you know, mm-hmm. there is no, it's like going to a film that has no conflict. It would be mm-hmm. nothing. It mm-hmm. wouldn't be real. It wouldn't be it wouldn't be a film, wouldn't be worthy of a film. And life by its nature is this spectrum of opposites. And when we are only living in that realm through the senses, in the realm of opposites, as Al calls it, in duality, he uses that as a shorthand for that, you know, then we will be unhappy. Then we will see things as good. This one part's good, this part's bad. But when you are moving through your practice to seeing also from this other aspect of things, you see that this is a plane of experience. Mm-hmm. And in the plane of experience, you must have these opposites.
Yeah, but that doesn't, that's like the background information.
And you have a role to play, and where you find yourself in that role, that's where you're acting.
Yeah. And that doesn't speak to the emotional reality of being in your role, right? When you're in the emotional reality of being in your role, it feels very hard to say, I accept the drama in all its parts, right? Because we're, you know, that's what keeps us locked in, the thoughts and the emotions about being where we are in the drama. Like, it's really, really hard to say to somebody who's hungry and oppressed, you know, see all the sides of this drama and then you'll stop struggling. Accept it, right? So acceptance, I'm going to go back to my main point, which is that acceptance doesn't mean not relating in an active way.
Right.
Right? The person who is hungry and oppressed, whatever that means, I don't know why I even chose that example, but the person who's in that role has the greater part of the challenge.
Right.
Right. Than the oppressor or the person who's not hungry. And from that perspective, right, it's really hard to see the big picture. And that's why yoga is hard.
Right.
Right. And so, like, I don't know. I get a little charged about this because when we speak in generalities, even if they're correct generalities, the people who are activists get pissed because they hear something different. And I think I'm speaking to that mind, you know, when I say, look, sometimes we have to be in the struggle and sometimes we have to do our practice from within the struggle. And sometimes we have to learn to let go of the struggle so that we can re-relate to what's happening in that bigger in that drama. Right? Like we forget that we have a choice about it when we're in it. And that's such a big, you know, ground level learning for me, you know?
Yeah.
You could substitute hungry and oppressed for sick and tired, you know?
Right. But I mean, to stick with this metaphor of a drama, you know, in the drama, the person who is hungry and oppressed is they are suffering.
Mm-hmm. They really are
challenged, but depending on their evolution, they may have a different relationship with that suffering. The person who is the activist, the role of that activist is to do something for the person who is suffering, to try to change the circumstances in a way that alleviates that suffering. So that person's job is to do that. Mm-hmm. But again, based on their own evolution, the way they relate to that action is going to be varied. They may have a different amount of acceptance about all of the parts of that. And, you know, it's like you can be aware of what's going on and still be fully engaged with what's going on. Or you can be living in duality completely and having the emotions and saying, this is wrong. It shouldn't be this way. You just said this 5 minutes ago.
Exactly.
You know? You can say it's wrong, but it's not wrong. It's just the way it is.
Right. But, and the teaching from yoga is that the first step to relating to it in a way that has integrity from the perspective of yoga is to become aware of the whole situation and your role in it. Like we can't separate ourselves out, because the reality is that we're always in it in some way, and we're always observing it in some ways. And that's, you know, when I talk about acceptance of the situation, that's what I'm talking about. Because I feel like whenever we get into trouble, like with that struggle place, it's because there's something we haven't accepted about the situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something inherently wrong with us. It's that there's something about the situation that we haven't accepted, and we haven't related to it in a way that's working to bring some ease. We're in the struggle, right? So it's, you know, some of it is just language. Some of it is just teaching how to understand, you know, how to, it's a different language. That's why I started with, it's a little bit of an inverse understanding. So, you know, I'm just really sensitive to the plight of the, you know, it's one thing to be in it and to be the one that's suffering. It's one thing to be in it and to be the one who thinks they should fix the suffering.
Right.
And it's another thing altogether to be somebody who is observing the whole thing and deciding how they can help.
Yeah.
You know, what they are supposed to do, what their dharma is around that thing.
Yeah, and I think we're in certainly in America and in much of the world right now, everyone's struggling with that question.
Absolutely.
Because there's a great deal of transformation that's being pushed by powers that be, and we're all trying to figure out, what does this mean to us? And some are elated by the transformation, and some are in suffering from the transformation, and others are in various stages of in between and trying to figure out what to do about it. And I think coming to the observer role, and the observer happens in two levels. There's the observing that is about like looking at what are your memories of this stuff, you know, estimating what's the future, what's the past, what's this got to do with me, all the things of manas, the mind that deals in the sensory world, that happens. And then there could be also this moving into the level of insight through a practice, and then letting that help you sort through the emotional quality, helping you see what does it mean, and helping you create the right relationship between all the factors in how you attack it, how you mm-hmm. take it on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I call that channeling your fire. You know, like you let the insight be the thing that channels your fire. You know, how you, how you act in the right way. Mm. So for you, right? And that's the other thing that is so...
Well, for you is finding your role.
It's finding your role. But it's so, so easy to think, okay, I figured this out for me. Now I'm going to teach that for everybody.
Yeah, that's for you. That's not necessarily for you, too.
That's the hardest part to, I think. It's hard in the sense that, you know, people just want to, it feels sometimes like people want to just be given away.
Yeah.
But that's not how it works, unfortunately. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, and you know, that comes back to that emotional component, because it's all residing in the second chakra and this notion of self, like myself, and you know, you should be like myself. Well, that's a very imbalanced place to be. That's very rajasic in that center. So we are trying to come to balance in all of our energy, you know, including our fire.
So I guess the other thing we need to distinguish between is when we're acting from ego, little I, and when we're acting from a place that takes that into consideration but isn't just locked into that pattern.
Which we said requires some time to understand and see that it's, oh, wait, no, when I get those messages, that's my insight talking. You know, and it does require time and practice and patience and learning. And
you got to go around that spiral a few times.
To understand what are vibhuti and what are just my own ego's desires.
That's a nice place to end.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Wendy.
Thanks, Peter.
Let's go start practicing Finnish again.
Okay.
Eksi uksi.
Uksi kaksi.
Uksi kaksi. That's one, two.
Kiitos.
Kiitos. Namaste.
Namaste.
That's today's episode of Peter's Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed my chat with Wendy, even though we're a little bit sleep deprived. And we'll be back from time to time. I've got some great podcasts coming while we're out on the road. And also, please consider coming and join us in France, August 14 to 19 in Normandy, France. Beautiful place to be, French countryside. Check out patreon.com, where I fund my podcast with contributions by people like you who value this and are willing to say so. patreon.com/Peter's Podcast. So we'll see you soon. Have a wonderful week. Namaste.